Hello, welcome once again to the Creative Writing Life podcast. I'm Paul Zeidman, and I'm thrilled to have a guest on. I've talked to him before, at least in print form. We did a kind of a Zoom call thing of his a couple of years ago, but this is a nice reconnection. Writing instructor, coach, and consultant, Jeff Kitchen. Jeff, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you. Great to see you again.
Good to see you too. Well, as regular viewers and listeners of the show know, we like to start things off talking about things we may have read or watched recently. Did we like it? Did we hate it? Are we indifferent? I will go first because Jeff needs to think about it. So I've still been enjoying Masters of the Air. That is playing on Apple Plus TV. Interesting. I like the way they're taking the story. It was a little kind of expected and unexpected the way that the last episode played out, but it'll be very interesting to see what they do. I'm not going to give any spoilers in case anybody's watching it. And my wife and I have been working our way through a show on Hulu called Death and Other Details, which kind of still undecided about it. It's kind of like, it's almost like Hulu saw how successful Only Murders in the Building was. And then they decided, let's do another kind of like stretched out mystery show. But the pacing in this one is so slow that it's so drawn out that it's 10 episodes. It could easily have been maybe 6 or 7 or 8 if they really pushed it. But there's a lot of flashbacks and a lot of, let's review things we've already talked about several episodes over. And it's just, it's like they're taking forever to get to the point of things. So there's still 2 episodes left as we're recording this. So it'd be interesting to see how they wrap it all up. But you know, those are the things we've been watching. And there's a couple of movies coming out that I'm looking forward to, but we'll get into that as they come out in due time. So Jeff, what about you?
Well, I watch a lot of movies, but the thing I'd have to say that I'm excited about right now is Dune, because I saw it in the theater, sat like in the front row, and really loved it. And then I saw it was on Netflix, and so I watched it again to see part two. And I was like, wow, this is like better than I remember. And I remember being like amazed by it. It was quite spectacular. And so I'm really looking forward to going to the theater and seeing part two, because it's getting rave reviews. And, you know, it seems like an excellent treatment of, you know, the story. And one of my favorite things is mind-bending science fiction. So Blade Runner, 12 Monkeys is one of my all-time favorite movies, because it doesn't explain itself, and it just kind of messes with your head. And I remember when I first watched it, I was like, what just happened? Like, what was that? And I was like, I had to go back and watch it again. And I was like, oh, okay, now it's actually making sense. Like, I loved it, but I was like, I actually don't know what happened in the ending.
Okay.
So I love that kind of kick you in the head and don't explain it type science fiction, mind-bending stuff. And Dune has a good chunk of that. You know, it's ambitious, and they're really bringing the talent and the production values to really, you know, execute it at a really high level. So I'm excited to go see that.
I also saw, I think it's like, it's at least maybe 2 hours, 45 minutes long. And I don't remember how long the first part was. So, you know, this is one of those, definitely prepare yourself for just to sit back and try and and enjoy it.
Right. I love that. You know, one of the rules of thumb that I heard many years ago is that if it's good, the longer it is, the better. Like when you said it's 2 hours and 45 minutes, I'm going, oh, thank goodness. Like, I hope it's not over too soon.
I think with this kind of story and the way that the director is really putting it all on the screen, I think it really pays off. And I did enjoy the first one, and I'm looking forward to seeing the second one as well.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Jeff, let's talk a little bit about you before we get into the main subject of the day. So, like, what's your background? I mean, are you the type who's always been a writer? Did you come into it later? Or what is the story of, like, how Jeff Kitchen became the writer and coach and consultant that he is today?
Well, I started out as a painter, and then a friend of mine was teaching a class on playwriting, and I had become fascinated with theater in prep school. I had three good English teachers in a row, and I responded to teachers I liked. So like this one Scottish teacher spent the whole semester reading Macbeth to us. And he would read a few lines and then talk about what was going on there and what was going on in the cultural milieu at the time in Elizabethan English and, you know, all these things. And he would talk about like a duel, and he would talk. And, you know, 45 minutes later, the tangents that he was discussing, he would say, be saying like, so the idea in the Old West that they could draw from the hip and shoot the gun out of the guy's hand, he goes, that's complete horse crap, because you could take one of those old pistols and put them in a vise and never hit the same spot twice. And it was like that, it just got me fascinated with it. And I was having to write papers about things and really digging into it, and found it fascinating. So when I had the chance to take this playwriting class, I jumped at it. And my teacher, Irving Fisk, said that you guys have to read these two books. And I had found one of them under his bed that summer. So he said, well, since you found the book I'd been looking for so long, why don't you take it first? And I sat down and read it all summer. It was this
book, the analysis
of Adic Principle, William Thompson.
Oh, you broke up a little bit, but I can kind of read the title, but it is extremely
faded.
It's not
easy to read anyway, but it's an old tome.
It is. It looks old.
And then I spent all winter reading his student's book, Playwriting for Profit.
Okay.
So I read these two books for 3 years, and they were very challenging, and I couldn't understand a lot of what Price was talking about at first. And his teaching style was every couple chapters, he would say, you probably don't fully grasp what I just said. And if you don't get that under your belt in a solid way, then you may as well just forget it. Like, because literally, if you don't understand this, the next part won't make sense either. So I would be like, yeah, he's right. I really don't get what he said. So I went back and like review the chapter. And I got to the end of reading the book, and I didn't feel like I knew the stuff, but I felt like it was kind of like tattooed on the inside of my brain, like hieroglyphics, like it was there, but I didn't know what it meant yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent all winter reading his student's book, and then I read his book and his student's book and his book. And in the third year, when I've really been studying this stuff with a kind of monastic ferocity, he summed it all up, because he'd been talking about this stuff for a couple chapters, and he said, look, the whole thing is sequence, proposition, plot. You apply that to the overall story, to each act, to each sequence, and to each scene, and as you do it to each scene, you write that scene. And I like literally saw a light bulb. My brain went click, 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 and I was like, holy crap. And it's like, it was like a real revelation of studying this guy for years, like all came together. And so I dug deeper into his student's book, and Price had died in 1920 before he wrote his next book. And his student kept saying he had these really advanced techniques that he was a top script doctor on Broadway around 1900. And the producer David Belasco had him revise each script before he produced it. He was working with top people, and so many writers were asking him for help that he formed the first school of playwriting ever in the history of the world. And he had 28 students, 24 of them had hits on Broadway. So he invented several new tools. And this tool, sequence, proposition, plot, was something that he only mentioned in this book. But his student didn't pick up on it. And his student was also saying that Price talked about advanced technique, but never fully explained it, and said, I'll write it in my next book. But then he died in 1920 before he did. So there was kind of an ongoing mystery of like, could they isolate and articulate exactly what he was talking about? And he said, Price gave me some hints. And one of these things opened up a way of structuring conflict. And it was kind of like a detective story where he was trying to recreate it. And I worked with my insight about sequence, proposition, plot. And Krauss, his student, used this double-sided conflict structure that advanced what Price was talking about. So I kind of discovered it laying incomplete in his book, pieced it together with some more stuff that his student had figured out, even though his student didn't get what he said about sequence, proposition, plot. And then I added some more to it and just worked with it for many years. And it's a very advanced plot construction and story development tool. And I've taught it to development executives at all the major Hollywood studios. And they consistently say that this is the most advanced story tool they've ever seen. It's really powerful. And I've just been teaching it for many years. I worked as a dramaturg in New York theater. I was hired by the Negro Ensemble Company to teach playwriting. And I've just been teaching playwriting and screenwriting, and then screenwriting and playwriting, New York, and then Los Angeles for many years. And it's just something that works. And people often say they've never seen anything like it, and that it works better than anything they've seen. So it's just something that I've enjoyed teaching and worked hard to find better ways to teach it. For 18 years, I taught intensive weekends, like a 30-hour weekend, 6 to 10 on Friday night, 9 a.m. to like 10 p.m. Saturday and Sunday. And, you know, you get like caffeine poisoning by the end of the weekend. And just kind of like fire hose teaching. And I took a break from that for a while. And when I came back to it, I was like, okay, so I don't want to be doing that type of fire hose teaching again. So what could I do? It was kind of like, how can I improve on that? And then I went the opposite way and said, wait a minute, instead of incrementally improving that, if I could wave a magic wand and go, okay, you could have anything you want, how would you teach it? And I was like, well, I would spend like 2 years on it and really, you know, do a full blown apprenticeship. So that's what I ended up teaching now. So I have this intensive 2-year training program that people can now sign up and take month by month, but it goes for 2 years. Like, you really do a full blown apprenticeship in it and get substantial skills in the tools.
Okay. So what is it that inspired this? So the new book we're talking about today, it's your new book, The Hero's Dilemma. So what was the inspiration for putting that one together?
Well, it's a strange inspiration. At the end of teaching for 18 years, I wrote my first book, Writing a Great Movie. And that kind of captured everything I'd been doing. And then I took some time off and was getting back into teaching. And in the process of teaching, I'm often turning over phrases like the best way to articulate something or the best way to be the most clear that people can understand. And I was turning over the phrase for dilemma, and I wrote down the hero's dilemma. And I was like, wow, that's interesting. And I went to my wife and I said, I came up with a really interesting title, The Hero's Dilemma. And she's like, you got to write that book right away. So I was like, okay, that makes total sense. So I just sat down and spent about a year and a half putting it together, trying to, the classes that I taught, the weekend intensive classes, were 6 people maximum. Each person had to bring their own story idea to work on during the weekend. So I would get you using the tools I'm teaching with you on your story to help you understand it better, so you get know-how, not just knowledge. And so I tried to emulate that in this book, where I explain the tool and then start a raw idea and work with trapping the protagonist in a good, strong dilemma between 2 equally unacceptable alternatives. Like, you see that in Training Day with the Ethan Hawke character, Jake, is caught between his ambition to make Alonzo's undercover narcotics squad, Alonzo is Denzel Washington, and his moral compass. Like, his ambition is like, I'll do anything to get in here. And his moral compass forbids him from going beyond a certain point. And Denzel's dragging him down this slippery slope of criminal policing. So he like can't let go of his ambition, and he can't let go of his moral compass. And that dilemma is what the movie's about. So that's what I teach. And so the way that I teach and the way that we build stories is, you get an idea and go right to dilemma and work on creating the dilemma as you create the story, so that you're creating drama from the outset, so that as you build the story, it's built around something like Jake's dilemma, where he can't let go of his ambition and he can't let go of his moral compass. And the dilemma suggests possibilities for the story, which enhances the dilemma further. And so you're building the drama as you're building the story. And so that's how this book is structured.
Okay, that actually raises a couple of things that I want to address, but we'll start with the basic one. So you're talking about dilemma. Now, how is dilemma compared to conflict? In the way that you're describing it, and also the way that you're trying to present it to the reader.
Yeah, it incorporates a lot of elements. Like, it incorporates conflict, and it includes inner conflict, external conflict. So for instance, if you look at Training Day, Jake has a lot of inner conflict about, you know, his ambition versus his moral compass, but he's also in conflict with Alonzo, because Alonzo is trying to drag him into, you know, undercover mode policing, which is, we don't obey all the rules, and you have to be a wolf to catch a wolf. And it's fascinating to watch the director's commentary on the DVD, because Antoine Fuqua says that all my friends are either in gangs or they're like cops, undercover cops. He said, so I was able to draw a lot from them and, you know, sit down with two of them in the same room and talk about it. He said, Jake knows that everything Alonzo's saying about how you got to fight dirty to be a good undercover cop, he knows all that's true, which makes it harder to, like, his moral compass is like, it can't be like this, but he knows that is how it is, and he can't reconcile those two. So there's a conflict that he has with Alonzo, while there's also an internal conflict, and that dilemma builds to a head at the point of crisis, at the three quarters point, where things come to the make or break point, and he has to make a decision about his dilemma and take an action. And then the end, he conclusively resolves his dilemma. I don't want to give away the ending for those people, sure, who haven't seen it, but the dilemma is readily apparent without spoiling the movie, and most people have seen it, so it's a good one to discuss. And you can see the dilemma easily, especially once somebody's pointed it out to you. You're like, yeah, wow, there it is, it's right there, and it's potent, it's compelling.
Well, okay, the other thing I want to ask is throughout the course of the book, you use Training Day, but also two other films as, I guess, solid examples of the hero's dilemma. And it's such an amazing variety of films. So you have Training Day, and the other two are Tootsie and Almost Famous. So,
right.
And I definitely see the dilemma and the conflict for both of those, but I want you to kind of expand a little bit. It doesn't matter which one you start with, but if you could kind of address,
sure,
both of them.
Well, Tootsie is a great example because it addresses the thing that people often have difficulty understanding, which is the sense of proportion. That, like, if you look at Training Day, you can see that the movie is about Jake's dilemma. And his dilemma isn't over until he conclusively resolves it in the end. He makes a decision and takes an action about it at the three quarters point, but he's still not resolved it until it's over. So it takes up most of the movie. It constitutes most of the movie. And so it takes some setup time for the dilemma to kick in. You have to get to know the protagonist and care about them, and the story has to develop. And Tootsie is an excellent example of that, because it's not until Michael Dorsey, who is bad with women, he's not good at forming relationships. He's kind of a hustler, wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, doesn't call people back. And he's also a brilliant actor, but he's difficult. And it's not until he dresses up and becomes Dorothy Michaels and gets the role on the soap opera that his dilemma really begins. And that's, you know, 15 minutes into the movie, something like that. We've gotten to really know Michael and care about him and see how he is troubled in certain ways and is the cause of a number of his problems. But once he becomes Dorothy, he's caught in a good, strong dilemma of magnitude where it's like it's unacceptable to quit being Dorothy because he's finally got work. He's got a fat paycheck. He's got respect as an actor. He's got clout on the set. He's like a hit. Like people like Dorothy right away and gravitate to her. And he's also got like his first real relationship with the woman that we've seen with the Jessica Lange character, Julie. Like he's falling in love with her, and because he's in a dress, he doesn't get to run his pattern on her and screw it up. So it's actually continuing to grow. And yet, so it's creating him. It's the best thing that's ever happened to him. Nothing's going to crowbar him away from this role. And yet, being Dorothy is complicating his life in many ways. The actor John Van Horn French kisses him as soon as his first day on the set. And he's realizing like, oh my God, it's a soap opera. They make out all the time. Like, what did I get myself into? I didn't even think of that. And it's like, it's complicated because he's in disguise and he's got to learn this double identity and he's running from room to room, putting on his wig and lying to people. And it's, and his relationship with Julie can only go so far because he's stuck as a woman. So, and that dilemma builds throughout Act Two, and it comes to a crisis when basically he kisses Julie while he's still dressed as Dorothy, and he's just had his contract renewed automatically. They had that option. So he's in for another year when he's thinking, I got to get out of this. This is making my life crazy. And so he kisses her and she freaks out. She's like, oh, I'm not gay. And he's like, no, if you could only see me out of this dress. And she's like, what? He's trying to say, I'm a man, I'm in love with you. But he doesn't get to say that because the phone rings and it's her father. And she's like, oh, you got to go let my dad down. Like, he's in love with you. You got to tell him you're a lesbian. And he's like, she sends him out with her dad. And he proposes to her. As soon as she gets there, she rushes out in a panic. On the way home, there's John Van Horn, the horny actor, who tries to rape her. And as soon as he leaves, Sandy, his friend with whom he's had a kind of an affair that blew up in his face, is at his door and he admits that he's in love with another woman and she blows up in his face. So all the lies that he's been juggling come down on his head all at once and he's got to make a decision and take an action about this dilemma of magnitude that he's stuck in. And that's around the three-quarter point. And I assume I can hopefully talk about the ending of the story because it's been around for many years and people have seen it. It's really against my religion to ruin a movie for somebody. So maybe I'll.
Well, it's like 43 years old. So.
Okay. So, his decision is basically like when they say somebody spilled celery tonic on the tape that was about to be broadcast, so we have to redo this one scene live. He's like, live TV, Dorothy ends here. I don't know how, but she's over. And his action is that he comes up with the most whopping lie yet to reveal that he's a man. And it's interesting because the original title of the movie was Would I Lie to You? And it's a story about how he's telling the truth about women, but he's living a lie. And the way that he finally tells the truth that I'm a man is to come up with the most whopping lie yet. So there's a lot of dramatic irony in it and so on. And that's his decision and action in the face of crisis now that his dilemma has come to the make or break point. And it doesn't go well because Julie, who's the one person he's fixed on, like I gotta get her, is she's furious at him. She comes over and slugs him in the stomach, doesn't want to ever see him. So his decision and action in the face of crisis has not resolved anything. He's out of the frying pan into the fire. He's in more trouble than he was before, but he's not stuck being Dorothy anymore and he's not paralyzed internally. And the same is true of Jake, that he's paralyzed between his ambition and his moral compass. And at the point of decision and action, he's no longer having an internal debate about Alonzo. And then Michael conclusively resolves his dilemma in the ending by winning over Julie. Look, he says, you know, he approaches her afterwards after he's made up with her dad. I'm really sorry. I didn't mean to hurt anybody. And he says that to Julie. He said, I only did it for the work. I never meant to hurt anyone, especially you. Like, I'm in love with you. Can we please try this again? And she's so angry. And he's like, you know, we already got over the hard part. We were already good friends. Can we please? And he warms her up and wins her over, because in the beginning, he was this kind of sleazy, manipulative guy with women. And now he's become a real person. The theme of Tootsie is that becoming a woman made a man out of Michael Dorsey. And the way that I articulate theme is to look at the resolution of the dilemma, the protagonist's resolution of the dilemma, and look at the way in which the protagonist resolves the dilemma. And that expresses the theme that's emerging organically through the complete action of the story. So if you look at the way that Michael resolves his dilemma, it's by being honest and real with her. He's like, I'm really sorry that I did not do this to hustle you. It was the opposite of that. I was just trying to get work. And he's really honest and straightforward, the opposite of how he was at the beginning of the story. And he really wins her over. And so he conclusively resolves his dilemma, which communicates the theme clearly and powerfully to the audience once at the end of the story. In Almost Famous, It's I've always loved the movie, and I saw Cameron Crowe at one point said the movie is about the kid reporter's dilemma, William. He said it's unacceptable to become friends with the band because he needs to be an objective reporter. He has to be honest and unmerciful, which is what his mentor teaches him. And yet it's equally unacceptable to not be friends with them because he's uncool and they're the coolest people he ever met. He wants to be in the in club. He wants to be in kind of living runaway with the circus. And he's really, and when Cameron Crowe said that, I was like, wow, that's what I teach, that the movie is about the dilemma. And like, I've found that most people haven't ever much heard of dilemma, much less know how to use it properly, except experienced professional writers express knowledge of it. But writing teachers often like have almost never heard of it. So it's an interesting thing that when he said that, I was like, wow, he really gets it. And that's what I teach. So I went back and watched it again. And I was like, damn, look at that. It's all throughout the story. The movie is about his dilemma all throughout. He's really trying to be an objective reporter. You know, they call him the enemy, and they're the people he wants to be with the most. And he's trying to be objective, and he's falling in love with Penny Lane, and he's becoming good friends with the lead guitarist. And he's like being drawn more and more into their world, but he's also trying to stay an outsider so he can be a real reporter, which he really wants to be. And as I studied it, I found also another element that contributes to that dilemma or dimensionalizes it further is his mother. Because he's skipped two grades, so he's 11 years old, I think, in high school. So he's kind of an outsider. He sits alone. People pick on him. He's smarter than them. So that outsider status as a reporter is bolstered by his normal life. And his mother says, don't be an idiot like those stone jocks that don't ever do anything. You know, you're going to have a great career as a lawyer. Like, keep it going. Stay focused. You're doing great. And he really is a good kid. He's doing what she tells him, even though she's calling him every day and don't do drugs. And she's hearing girls in the background and Marianne's arriving with the pot. And she's like, wait, what? No, not this. But he's really like, he's a mother's dream. So like, she has built his whole life to this outsider status. Like, he's made for this. He's naturally an outsider. And yet he's also naturally starving to be an insider because he's always been excluded. and his mother hates rock and roll, and it's his primary love. And it's all these kind of contradictions that are at war inside him. And so it's a fascinating look at, you know, one good, strong dilemma carries the film and constitutes much of the film. I talk about dilemma as like having a whale in your living room. Like, it takes up most of the room. You can walk around it, and it's not like the only thing in there. But, you know, after some setup time, the dilemma kicks in for, like, you know, somewhere before or around the end of Act One, you want your protagonist caught up in this dilemma, and that dilemma should continue for the rest of the movie until the point of resolution. So it's big. It's not a 5-minute dilemma that gets quickly resolved. It's the big thing that the protagonist, the fundamental decision that the protagonist is wrestling with.
Okay. What I love
is
what you're describing is that with each of these three stories, that we start with the character and that the dilemma grows, but I guess it also, the complications keep ensuing and almost like start doubling and like folding in on themselves, that it just keeps getting more and more complicated. And this character is at the middle of it. And things that they think are in the beginning are under their control, but as they progress, that they become more and more out of their control. And we, as the audience, we are so mesmerized. We want to see how are they going to deal with this? Because that's one of the things I always tell writers is you want the what's on the page, you want the reader to turn the page. You want them to have to know what happens next. And with all of these complications growing around our central character, we're just caught up. We just have to see, like, oh my gosh, things just keep getting worse for this character. They're getting deeper and deeper into this, you know, maze, this labyrinth of problems. How are they going to get out of it?
Yeah. And so, yes, the dilemma gets more and more complex. The pressure gets more and more intense. And the need, like, as Jake is progressing through training day, not only is Alonzo getting more and more criminal, like Jake's brain is going, I can't do another second with this guy, but he's also making tremendous progress. And Alonzo is like really leapfrogging. He says Jake is alternately appalled and impressed by Alonzo. So the more that he sees of Alonzo on one hand, the more he's like, I cannot do this. And the more that he sees how the huge steps that Alonzo's making to get places, he's like, I can't let go of this. And to complicate that, Alonzo shows Jake because of Jake's ambition. The director Antoine Fuqua talks about that as his hamartia, his fatal flaw. And he says, you know, Jake says to him in the car after they shoot Roger, you've been planning this all day. He goes, I've been planning this all week. You know, this is, you're playing checkers, I'm playing chess. He picked him for his ambition. He had that vulnerability because all Alonzo needs is a virgin shooter to claim he shot Roger. He's a first-time cop, shot a known drug dealer of magnitude. He's going to get a slap on the wrist. Alonzo gets his $1 million. Jake makes his squad and is on his way to detective. And so, but what Alonzo didn't know was that Jake is a naturally brilliant cop. He says, you got the magic eye. And partly the brilliance of casting Denzel Washington, who prior to that movie had often played righteous, intense, good people. And so when he says, you got the magic eye, he's very convincing. We know this guy, and he's like, we believe him. And see, the thing is that Antoine Fuqua said everything that Alonzo tells him is true. And so, and when he says, you got the magic eye, that's true. And so, and Alonzo is saying, you are a good leader. All my guys in there are clowns. Like, you'll go to the head of the class instantly. And so Jake's ambition is working out. He's doing better and better and better. So it's harder and harder to let go of that because he's pulling it off. And yet the destructive criminality that Alonzo is engaging in, you know, he says that was murder and armed robbery in there. And Alonzo said, well, we just took one of the biggest drug dealers off the street. So it's the war between the two.
Okay. And one of the things I want to talk to you about is that you have a quote from Lee Child, the author of the Jack Reacher series. It says, "All stories have a purpose, and the older and more durable the story, the more elemental the purpose is likely to be." And I just thought that was just brilliant. And so I was hoping you could kind of expand on that just a little bit.
Yeah, it's a great quote. And I love the Reacher series. I've read them all multiple times. And Stephen King said that Jack Reacher is the most interesting recurring character in modern fiction. So it's when I saw the book, or I think my wife got it for me, called The Hero by Lee Child, and I was writing about the hero's dilemma, it was interesting to read about. And that quote was particularly potent. And I had to kind of decipher that. I had to, I kind of know what he means by elemental, like the stories that have the longest, the most durable stories are deal with the most elemental things in life. And I was like, okay, so I kind of know what that means, but I'm always going to the dictionary because as a wordsmith, I'm using the thesaurus and I want, like, yeah, I looked that word up in fifth grade, so I know what it means, but that's different than like as a professional wordsmith coming back at it. And it says things like that have to do, I'm paraphrasing, but it's like things to do with survival and the most core things that make life work and so on. And it makes sense because, you know, the stories that last the longest are the ones that teach us how to navigate life and how to survive and how to continue. And so it was interesting, like getting at the things that people can really identify with. And that was one thing I wanted to add to your point before, was that not only does the dilemma get more and more complicated, but you have to make sure that the audience can identify with the protagonist's dilemma. Are they caught in something similar to that? You know, most of the viewers of Training Day are not undercover cops, but they're like, I've been in a thing where like my ambition versus my conscience, like I'm caught in that now in varying degrees. So it's an important part of working with dilemma to make sure that the audience can really connect with it. Otherwise, you're putting all this energy into something that they're like, doesn't do anything for me. I'm not drawn into it. So that's another key factor in it.
Yeah, that's something that I talk to writers about a lot, is that even though your story may be about a particular kind of character that is the total opposite of what you are or what you do for a living, that you want to make the character relatable to the reader and the audience, so that I may not be an undercover cop, but I know exactly what this guy is going through. I'm not an actor trying to, pretending to be somebody else, but I can understand why he's doing that. So it's all about the relatability for your characters, and that if your audience can connect with that, that it's very effective. And it's great to see a writer kind of grasp that as they work on their script and kind of develop their characters. That I've read so many scripts where I don't care about the characters because they're one dimensional, or there's only one emotion that they're all about. But if they're layered and they're three dimensional and there's something about them that I can connect to, there's some kind of little connection there, I think that really puts a lot of writers ahead of most of the others.
Yeah, and that's where, like they say, the deeper you go, the more universal you get. And I think that's where the elemental aspect comes in, because if you're talking about what it takes to survive in life and to make your life work, then everybody can connect to that. So that, you know, like a banker in Tokyo could be like, yeah, I'm not, you know, if the story's about like a fisherman in Alaska, but the banker in Tokyo is like, yeah, I'm dealing with honor and doubt and betrayal and things like that, like I can connect. You know, and a farmer in Brazil can be like, yeah, I completely get that, because it's deep and it's universal.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so one last thing I want to talk about today is this is one of the things you talk about, is that your script must work dramatically. A script works dramatically because the writer creates a specific effect known as dramatic action. Now, I know dramatic action, like, you know, that's a whole new category unto itself, but can you touch briefly on what you mean by the dramatic action and how it would help contribute.
Yeah, that's really at the core of the craft of the dramatist, because you've got to be a great storyteller. But if it's only a great story, that doesn't necessarily mean it will make a great script, because you're writing for a performance medium. It has to be on, it has to be acted out on stage by actors, whether it's a sound stage for TV or film or live theater. It has to be actable, and it has to hold an audience riveted, which means it's consistently compelling. And so dramatic action is a state of subjective excitement. It's a way that you draw in the audience where they're on the edge of their seat, trying to figure out the mental puzzle, like who killed who, whatever, the emotional puzzle. Will he see that the person he thinks is his enemy is actually the one who's helping him the most? Like, the more that you can make a good story compelling and actable and consistently compelling, you don't want dead spots where it's reverts to flat narrative, because then the audience is starting to check their watch and it doesn't work. You've got to keep them riveted. And so dramatic action is the name of the game. You've got to have consistent, coherent dramatic action. Coherent means it's one main action, one thing that's happening, so that there's a focus and a drive and a forward action, and that it really grips the audience and holds them and transforms them. But that's different than dramatic action.
Yeah, well, like I said, like this is opening up several new doors and into paths that we just don't have the time to discuss. Let's start to wrap things up. So Jeff, the book is The Hero's Dilemma. Now, I also wanted to. There it is. There, he's holding it right there for those watching it. Yeah, and for if you're listening to it, he's still holding up a copy of the book. Jeff, in addition, or like we talked about, a writing instructor. So you offer a lot of online classes. Now, how can people find out more about those classes? Because they seem to be going on all the time.
Yeah, I'm doing a live ongoing 2-year training program, which you can join at any time. You just have to take a few of the classes so that you understand what we're doing, because we're always in the middle of developing multiple scripts. It's hands-on. It's a full-blown apprenticeship. And so people who want to join the live ongoing advanced training need to take about 8 classes in my subscription program, which gives you basic functionality in the varying tools, and then you can make sense of what you jump into the middle of, and you'll be up to speed very quickly. So that's $400 a month. You can take it as long as you want. That'll be up on the website soon. And there is a self-study program that takes anywhere from 3 to 6 months, where you work with me in a pre-recorded video where I create, develop, construct an original thriller, and then you actually write the script from the detailed outline that you've worked along with me building. So it's as interactive as I can make a pre-recorded video. And then there I have evening classes on different subjects and individual consulting and my 2 books, Writing a Great Movie and The Hero's Dilemma.
And what is the website for people to find out this information?
It's script.kitchen. There's no .com. It's .kitchen, script.kitchen.
Okay. And if somebody, are you on social media? If someone wants to follow you on any of the platforms?
Yeah, I'm on, what I'm most active on is LinkedIn and Facebook. I have a presence on other ones, but I'm so busy that it's hard to maintain all that. So that's the easiest places to find me.
Okay. Well, that is some great stuff. This has been a fascinating and really informative discussion, Jeff. I really appreciate you being able to come on today and talk about this.
Great.
And so the book is The Hero's Dilemma. And this is Jeff Kitchen. And as he said, his website is script.kitchen. Jeff, thank you once again for being on today. This was just great.
Absolutely. And anybody can send me an email at jeff@script.kitchen.
at jeff@script.kitchen. Fantastic. Okay, well, this has been Jeff Kitchen, the author of The Hero's Dilemma. I'm Paul Zeidman, host of the Creative Writing Life podcast. You can also check out my screenwriting blog, maximumz.blog. I've got a couple of posts that involve interviews with Jeff about some of his various works over the years. You can also check me out on Twitter at @maximum_z and on Instagram at @PezScreenwriting, P-E-Z screenwriting. Like I said, he's Jeff. I'm Paul. This has been the Creative Writing Life podcast. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy. Most importantly, go write something.